It's a privilege to be here today, passing on to you not only the teachings of my great teacher, Shunryu Suzuki Roshi, but by passing on the meaning of his teachings, giving meaning to the practice of all of the great Buddhist ancestors, all the way back to Shakyamuni Buddha. Today's talk, the last in the series on Bodhidharma's precepts, is on Bodhidharma's 10th precept, no abusing the triple treasure, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And this is the second one of Bodhidharma's precepts, the first being no dwelling on past mistakes, that is not in our current list of 10 grave precepts. So our fourth series in this series of talks was on the 16 precepts, but the 10 grave precepts did not include dwelling on past mistakes, nor no abusing the triple treasure. So it's really interesting that we don't have this precept actually in our current list. And here's the precept. Self nature is mysteriously profound. In the midst of one dharma, in the midst of one great truth, not to give rise of mind of sentient being or Buddha is called precept of no abusing the triple treasures. So at first it seems a little strange, like to couple the idea of not even to think of a sentient being or a Buddha, thinking of a sentient being or a Buddha can be harmful to the Buddha Dharma Sangha. Like, how is that? How do they even relate to each other? But it's a strong reminder, it serves as a really strong reminder that we don't exist the way we think we do. It's a strong way of saying that Buddha and sentient beings cannot be divided. So you can't say Buddha, because it's as if Buddha exists separately from us. Or you can't say me, or you can't say that person. Because there's only one thing. There's just one interconnected net, really, of existence. And we're all one and we're interconnected. And that's the ultimate truth that we can't understand with our minds. And I'm going to say something about that later in this talk. But why do we call them treasures? And Koban Chino Otogawa, whose words I've passed on to you throughout this series, because he's so profound, he says that Buddha is, these Sanskrit words, Anuttara Samyak Sambodhi. You'll hear them again and again if you study Buddhism, Anuttara Samyak Sambodhi, supreme complete awakening. So Buddha is, why are these called treasures? Because Buddha is Anuttara Samyak Sambodhi, complete supreme awakening. Dharma is truth, which has never been stained. There's no way to stain it. And Sangha is the entire contents of supreme awakening, the harmonious manifestation of truth in form. So Buddha is complete and perfect enlightenment. You can say that Buddha is complete and perfect enlightenment. Dharma is truth, and Sangha is the harmonious manifestation of truth. You can leave it at that. Buddha is complete and perfect enlightenment. Dharma is truth. And Sangha is the harmonious manifestation of truth. That's why they're called treasures. And those are what the treasures are. Koban goes on, and I want to share with you what his short talk consists of, because it's very wonderful. He's saying now, within a session, so it's a very environment of people who have done nothing but zazen for days. So when he's sharing with them, the ground of the deeper meaning of triple treasure is shikantaza, zazen. Bodhidharma speaks of this no abusing the triple treasure as understanding that our essence of existence, continuous awakening, is nothing but our basic nature. That's who we are. We are continuous awakening. He teaches that self-nature is profound, contained in one truth. Not to give birth to the dualistic observation that you and Buddha are different existences, not to give birth to dualistic thinking about sentient being and Buddha, that is called no abusing triple treasure. To think of the triple treasure somewhere outside of you is the beginning of abusing and departing from it. You are keeping yourself from it. If you understand Buddha and sentient beings as different beings, you are misunderstanding triple treasure and making the biggest mistake. You are cutting the Buddha's body and looking at his blood running. This is what Koban is saying. It's very visceral here. What Sangha is really knowing the harmony of life, the peace of living, the freedom of life. It is a very interesting thing to feel, really feel how others are living. It's an interesting thing to really feel how others are living. When you meet one little being, it might be a mosquito or a pine tree or a rock. To become Buddha with each of them is your practice. Do you understand? That's what he says. You become Buddha with each of them. This is communicating with a being that appeared for you to make sure you are enlightened. It is also enlightened. This is how everything is actually happening, but sometimes neither one knows what is going on. Sometimes both completely know what is going on. If you believe in yourself as the creation of the absolute existence, whose presence is the only presence, then no problem. There is no separation between creator, creation, and created thing. You simply admit that you are an extension of the creation, a part of it, accepted by it. Eventually, the effort becomes how to live within the intention of the creator. To find this out and follow this way is to live. It sounds, that sounds very Christian, actually. But anyway, he's saying it. For each newborn person, this learning has to be done all over again. Maybe polishing of your own individuality has to be done all over again. A new generation cannot depend on parents or grandparents to be their utter support. So each individual has to start way-seeking all over again. Learning a language, how to hold a fork and knife, everything. We have to learn it all over again. Conditioning and ordinary common sense tells us that we are not enlightened. So we think that. First, and we have to practice to become enlightened. But the Soto Zen tradition denies this and introduces Zazen as the perfected action, the goal of practice. This is Dogen Zenji's view. People know that Chikantaza is Buddha Dharma, but rarely do people understand this. From the very beginning, utter belief that you are Buddha is required. You do not need to think about it, just do it. It's like a swimming teacher pushing you in the water, but the push is not necessary. First you try, let your hand touch the water, maybe try a few exercises. Then you swim and you get to know what it is. Instead of walking around the pool and discussing the philosophy of swimming day after day. So he's saying that's a metaphor for we just get that we're Buddha. There's no such thing as me and Buddha separately. I am Buddha. That's our attitude. I am Buddha. And he's saying here, it's required. He said, from the very beginning, utter belief that you are Buddha is required. And this is what Bodhidharma is also saying. When we study the precepts, we are studying our life in a very clear way. You come to it with an empty mind, but sometimes it is better not to study too much. If we have just a little blink of precepts, you can develop them alone because the whole thing is within you. I have said that it feels like there is just one great limitless precept at the very center of my being. And if I cannot sense it, I'm always a little away from it. This is Koban talking. At that time, it feels like I'm messing up my life as well as the life of others. Then I get more and more shy, especially when someone requests Dokusan, which is a private interview. It feels like I am in an extremely fancy and advanced university where people are all professors while I'm the only student. If someone does not appear at Dokusan time because of traffic or a sudden stomach ache or something, I feel I am saved. It is a very shaky life. Not to mess up is pretty hard practice. So that's the end of what he has to say. He's such an elegant and profound teacher. It's a pleasure to share this with you. He has a way of saying things that make them feel so close to you. And yet there's so much a part of this ultimate truth world. So then how do we protect and sustain the triple treasure? How do we do that? And I'm going to suggest 12 ways. And the first one is Suzuki Roshi felt that encouraging people to practice upright sitting was his primary way to protect and sustain the triple treasure. So for us, it would be Zazen. That would be the follow through of what Suzuki Roshi said in terms of protecting and sustaining the triple treasure. He is saying upright sitting. And secondly, for him, the most pure and direct way of sustaining the Buddha treasure was just to be fully himself in each moment. His way of protecting the Dharma treasure was to practice wholeheartedly with no gaining idea. So to practice Zen Buddhism wholeheartedly with no gaining idea, whatever that is. I mean, whatever Zen Buddhism is. His way of protecting and sustaining the Sangha treasure was what he called group practice, which he upheld even to the detriment of his physical health. He insisted on eating in the Zendo with everybody. Meals in a monastery are held in the Zendo. And brown rice was served in our Zendo. and he couldn't chew it. And so he didn't get enough to eat. I think he lost 10 pounds. And his wife was outraged and wanted him to eat, you know, later, like in his cabin, but he wouldn't do it. He, you know, I'm eating with everybody and that's the end of it. And so he lost weight. But that was his way of sustaining the triple treasure, the Sangha part of this, of the triple treasure. And thirdly, ultimately, this precept is realized by fully appreciating and supporting the self-expression of all life. This means we see Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha manifesting in all phenomena of our everyday existence. And in the widest sense, Sangha includes all beings and indicates the harmonious interdependence of all beings. That means we receive Dharma from all beings. It's very thorough. We receive Dharma from all beings. Fourthly, we do not objectify the Buddha. There's that adage, if you see the Buddha on the street, kill him. Because we don't make, we don't set him apart and idealize him and make Buddha into something. Why? Because we're not separate from Buddha. And so if we start idealizing Buddha or making like, oh, Buddha, that's dualistic thinking and it's incorrect. And fifth, thoroughly studying, and this is an interesting one. The fifth way of protecting and sustaining the triple treasure is studying and completely understanding the Dharma. For example, it would be disparaging the Dharma to say that there are no past and future lives, or that moral causation does not really function, or that there do not exist beings who have traveled the path and attained nirvana. So to refuse to contemplate the possibility of these stories being literally true undermines the foundation for understanding the ultimate liberating significance of the precepts and is disparaging the Dharma. So these things that we're taught, they're the core understandings of Zen Buddhism. And to kind of not allow yourself to enter them fully is disparaging the Dharma. And sixth, the Sangha, it's very important to understand it as a field of refuge. All beings, all the beings that we turn to for support, encouragement, and teaching in our Dharma practice, we fully develop these resources moment by moment. And ultimately, we disparage the Sangha when we overlook or close off any of these resources of awakening. So any of the resources open to you for learning more about Zen, if you close them off or disparage them, you're disparaging the Sangha. Seventh, it's about being upright. And when we're being upright, that's when the precepts are fully manifested. And without being physically upright, the triple treasure is not fully expressed. And your speech and actions will inevitably disparage them, even though you do not intend to do so. So this upright sitting is important in the sense that it's not only in the Zendo. We have an upright attitude in our daily life as well. Dogen taught that the triple treasure is unfathomable, and he encouraged us to receive it with the utmost devotion and respect. It means to have the utmost respect and devotion for all beings. I think that's really hard to do. And I think the only way you can really do it is, I've been practicing this lately. I'll share this with you. And this is about this idea of having the utmost respect and devotion for all beings. So if you're driving down the street and you see people walking on the sidewalk, I mean, I've been saying to myself, oh, that's a sentient being. Oh, look at that. There's another sentient being. There's another sentient being that it's a dog. It's a sentient being. And there's another sentient being. For me, calling individuals sentient beings helps me to see them as sentient beings for which I have the utmost devotion and respect. And it takes it out of this kind of realm where I might not have that. So at least to start practicing that, I'm finding it helpful to kind of elevate everybody to the category of a sentient being. And then it's easier to get in touch with devotion and respect for a fellow sentient being. This may not make any sense to you, but it's helping me. Okay, this ninth one is something that Dogen says, and it's a little, I'm just going to read it, and it's the way Dogen always is. So Dogen says, the body is manifested. It means that Buddha's body must become your body. The blood vein of the precepts must become your blood. Your body must be realized as Buddha's body. Your blood as Bodhisattva precept blood. In other words, you must respond to life as Buddha responds to life. Only in this way can you become physically free of your visceral self-clinging. Remember, it's our self-clinging that keeps us in samsara. Then Dogen says, when your bodily presence and actions immediately demonstrate the first 9 grave precepts, the Dharma flower opens as your own body in this 10th and final grave precept. And then the 10th one is not disparaging the Buddha is to see that his lifespan was actually without end and that he is always present. We've talked about this before when a nun was copying the Lotus Sutra, and as she was copying, she realized she heard Shakyamuni Buddha speaking the Lotus Sutra on Vulture Peak right now. And that was her actual experience as she copied the Lotus Sutra. And here this 10th one is saying that his lifespan is without end and that he's always present. And we see this by practicing all virtues and are upright and honest, gentle and harmonious in every aspect of our life. So if we remember that we are Buddha, I am Buddha, then this makes sense completely. So there's two more. The 11th one is the traditional stories of Zen practice teach that in all of our encounters, we must settle the self upon the self and meet the other in order to fully realize the Dharma. Such meetings between beings in this world are truly rare and wonderful. It reminds me of what Coben said about we meet a mosquito, we meet another being as the Buddha, and we become the Buddha with them. And we're both, and in that act of becoming Buddha with another being, their enlightenment and our enlightenment are activated. And then the last one, the true suchness of all Dharma was not the moment when Buddha awakened as he sat under the great tree of enlightenment and witnessed the morning star. That was not the moment. The true suchness of all Dharma was realized when Buddha successfully taught the Dharma face to face to another being. At that moment, the Dharma was exhaustively realized. Only when a Buddha is teaching and transmitting the Dharma is Buddhahood fully realized. So, in other words, I've mentioned this before, something that Reb said, that there's no such thing as an enlightened person, only enlightened activity. And that's basically what this is saying. The suchness of all Dharma was not the moment when Buddha awakened under the Bodhi tree, but when he actually taught the Dharma successfully, face to face to another being. So those are 12 ways to protect and respect the triple treasure, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And I'd like to close this series on the 10 grave precepts from an ultimate truth standpoint by giving you another paradigm for thinking about ultimate versus conventional truth. So it's really difficult to work with ultimate truth, as you know. But this idea that you're going to like this is really easy. This idea is put forth by a woman named Cynthia Bourgeau, who's an Episcopal priest. She's an Episcopal priest who writes and lectures on the world's wisdom traditions. And it's taken from her book called The Wisdom Jesus, A New Perspective on Christ and His Message, published by Shambhala, the Buddhist Press, in 2011, actually. So it's a book about the Christian mystical tradition published by a company that specializes in Buddhism. And I leave it to you to judge if you can tell the difference. To me, it simply presents what we have been struggling with in this series in a super easy and up-to-date vocabulary. So listen to this. In her paradigm, there are two operating systems. Okay, there are two operating systems. The first is the egoic operating system, the operating system of the mind. This system, already installed in us, is a binary operating system. It runs on the power of either or. People frequently call it ego, but she prefers to stick with her metaphor and call it the egoic operating system. And it's the operating system of the mind. She explains that the egoic operating system is really the grammar of perception, a way of making sense of the world by dividing the field into subject and object, inside and outside. And one of the most important tasks of early childhood is to learn how to run the operating system. By the time she was 1.5, her granddaughter could already sing along with a Sesame Street jingle, "One of these things is not like the other," and pick out the cat from among three dogs. She didn't realize, of course, that this is really elementary training for her egoic operating system, which perceives through differentiation, me and her, dog and cat. And so this egoic operating system thinks in terms of good and bad, right and wrong, before and after, up and down. Our sense of identity generated through the egoic operating system is actually an illusion. It is the great religious, as the great religious traditions have always said, there is no independent self, no egoic being, no thing that is separated from everything else. All these impressions are simply a function of the operating system that has to divide the world up into bits and pieces in order to perceive it. We walk through our lives perceiving, reacting to, and attempting to negotiate the world out there, on the basis of this operating system. It's like being lost in a mirage. A system based in duality can't possibly perceive oneness. It can't create anything beyond itself, only duality and more trouble. I hope you're listening up. And this is from a Christian mystic. Okay, now we have the second operating system. It's called the non-dual or unitive operating system, the operating system of the heart. While the egoic operating system is particularly related to the mind, to the binary operator built right into the human brain, the heart connects with a seamless and indivisible reality through a whole different way of organizing the informational field. We almost always think of the heart as the center of our personal emotional life, you know, oh, I love so-and-so. But in the wisdom tradition, the heart is primarily an organ of spiritual perception. We perceive through the heart. Thomas Merton once wrote, "At the center point of our being is a point of nothingness, which is untouched by sin and illusion, a point of pure truth, a point of spark, which belongs entirely to God. From time immemorial, wisdom teaching has insisted that only through that point of nothingness can we enter the larger mind. Whatever we call this seamless and indivisible reality at the center of our being, our role in this human plane is to bring it into form and fullness." So this refrain of conventional and ultimate, of our kind of conventional and ultimate truth conundrum, I think is brilliant. And in its easy adaptability to contemporary vocabulary, our 2-year-olds with their iPads are already receiving versions of operating systems for Christmas. They've got operating systems. You know, if you have a problem with your computer, go ask a 6-year-old. So thinking of conventional truth as an operating system of the mind with its distinctions and partialities, as opposed to ultimate truth's rootedness in the heart, which bypasses all that stuff, makes it so easy. When I picture Bodhidharma overhearing one of his disciples referring to ultimate truths as territory of the heart, I think he'd be quite comfortable. I mean, actually, it's happening right now, right here. Bodhidharma hasn't gone anywhere. So here are some of the most important points. First, not to give birth to the dualistic observation that you and Buddha are different existences. Not to give birth to dualistic thinking about sentient beings and Buddha. That is called no abusing triple treasure. Second, to think of the triple treasure somewhere outside of you is the beginning of abusing or departing from it. You are keeping yourself from it. If you understand Buddha and sentient beings as different beings, you are misunderstanding triple treasure and making the biggest mistake. You are cutting the Buddha's body and looking at his blood running. Third, it is a very interesting thing to feel, really feel how others are living. When you meet one little being, it might be a mosquito or pine tree or rock, to become Buddha with each of them is your practice. Do you understand? Fourth, when we study the precepts, we are studying our life in a very clear way. Fifth, for Suzuki Roshi, the most pure and direct way of sustaining the Buddha treasure was just to be fully himself in each moment. His way of protecting the Dharma treasure was to practice wholeheartedly with no gaining idea. His way of protecting and sustaining the Sangha treasure was what he called group practice, which he upheld even to the detriment of his physical health. And finally, sixth, it would be disparaging the Dharma treasure to say that there are no past and future lives, that moral causation does not really function, that there does not exist, that there do not exist beings who have traveled the path and attained nirvana and so forth. To refuse to contemplate the possibility of these stories being literally true undermines the foundation for understanding the ultimate liberating significance of the precepts and is disparaging of the Dharma. And here are some ideas for your reflection during the week. First, what does Bodhidharma mean when he says, self-nature is mysteriously profound? What does that mean? And second, what is the correct way to understand the triple treasure, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, according to Kobenchino? Third, Suzuki Roshi's way of protecting the Dharma treasure was to practice wholeheartedly with no gaining idea. When he says practice, he means everything he does throughout his whole life and daily life. Are you able to do this? If not, where are the places in your life that you would mark as either being less than wholehearted are done with a gaining idea? So what, looking at your life, what activities do you do less than wholeheartedly, or that you do with a gaining idea, just to make the whole thing conscious? And then here's a statement. The true suchness of all dharmas was not the moment when Buddha awakened as he sat under the great tree of enlightenment and witnessed the morning star. The true suchness of all dharma was realized when Buddha successfully taught the dharma face to face to another being. At that moment, the dharma was exhaustively realized. Only when a Buddha is teaching and transmitting the dharma is Buddhahood fully realized. So another way of saying this is that there's no such thing as an enlightened person, only enlightened activity. Do you believe this? That's the question. So that whole thing you've heard now several times, do you believe it? And could you elaborate on your ideas and your opinions? Maybe you don't believe it. Why? What are your reasons for that? So either on either side that you land, yes, I do believe it, here's why, or no, I don't believe it, here's why. It's important that you know what you think. It's important. And then also, the statement of Thomas Merton's, at the center point of our being is a point of nothingness, which is untouched by sin and illusion, a point of pure truth, a point of spark, which belongs entirely to God. How does this statement of a Christian mystic relate to Buddhism? What do you see as the connecting point? Because in Buddhism, we don't talk about God. We just don't talk about it. Although actually Suzuki Roshi has talked about it in a very positive way. But the question I'd like you to reflect on during the week is, at the center point of our being is a point of nothingness, which is untouched by sin and illusion, a point of pure truth. You can leave it at that if you want. What does all that mean? I wonder if there are questions. Here's one that we received already. I liked when Coben said, if we have just a little blink of precepts, you can develop them alone because the whole thing is within you. It does seem that the precepts, if we look, are already there. And when we can't find them, we are somehow out of balance. I've noticed this too. I know that, it's sort of like we all have this, we all can tell when we're sort of on or when we're off. It's good if you feel off, like, and in this case, it would mean you've lost that inner sense of uprightness, the sense of you, of your correctness, your interior built-in correctness. Or we could even say you've lost the connection with your the operating system of your heart. And it would seem like that is totally built in. But let me tell you a story. It's very depressing. This is a story about a senior in college that I counsel. And she went on a date with somebody 2 years younger than her. And to get something for this party they were going to, they went to Target. They went together to Target. And he picked up the item he needed. And he said, I'm going to steal this. And she said, I'm not leaving the store if you don't pay for it. You know, I'll pay for it. And they argued about it, and eventually he paid for it. And then when they got out of the store, he said, you know, I could go back in that store and get another one and walk out with a receipt, and they'd never know the difference. And this is a boy whose father had just bought him a new Tesla. So he would be, what, a sophomore in college? So I'm thinking that with his slickness, and it's almost like a habit, and so we already know that he does this all the time, and probably all his friends do this all the time. And I feared that this mind, the people who don't yet know, they don't yet, that boy has the operating system of the heart inside of him, but he's totally out of touch with it. And it's very scary. He's operating only with the operating system of the mind, the ego, the egoic operating system. So me, I want this, so I'm gonna take it. That's all. Here's another one that we received. I was a little shocked to hear that if you think there are no past and future lives, it would be disparaging the Dharma treasure. I'm slowly coming around to the idea of past and future lives, but I never thought that not believing this would be so serious. Why is that? And the reason why is it's not that you need to believe that per se, but the rock bottom basis, the core foundation of Buddhism, is cause and effect. So when there's an effect, there's always a cause. So for example, you're an effect. You can think of yourself as an effect. And there's a cause. There's a cause for you. And the cause is partially actions that you've laid down in your past lives. So, and also, you're a cause for an effect in the future. So actions that you lay down in this lifetime will affect your future lives. So this, there are tomes about the details, but, and it's not about the belief per se, but it's about this core idea of when there's an effect, there's always a cause. And so there's a part of Buddhism that's super logical, and it's very straightforward and completely clear, not like this ultimate truth stuff. Thank you for asking. And then here's another really pertinent one that came in. What does manifesting upright being really mean? And that's a really great question, because we hear upright sitting a lot. And upright sitting means zazen, but being upright means it's actually one of Reb's favorite terms, and his book called Being Upright is about the precepts. But it actually means acting in accordance with our understanding of interconnectedness and therefore harmony in all of your relationships. So being upright is acting in accordance with our interconnectedness and therefore harmony in all of our relationships. And most of us, that means listening to what other people think and feel. And at least many of us, let's say, myself included, we don't really like to listen to people whose way is, I detest, let's say. Do I really want to listen to them? And the answer is, you know, yes, I need to learn how to listen to them. And that's very important. Listening to them is important. And the attitude that I just said, you know, that I have even, is exactly what being upright is not. That is not being upright. So being upright is getting up on time, sitting zazen on time, respecting all beings, respecting all beings, and not being lazy is another one. Thank you. Here's one more. If you believe in yourself as the creation of the absolute existence, whose presence is the only presence, then no problem. There is no separation between creator, creation, and created thing. When I hear words like this, I feel like I'm in church. He said absolute existence instead of God, but the Christian way is all there. And it's surprising in a talk on Zen Buddhism. And I find it interesting that this Japanese priest raised in Japan with a Japanese priest, his father was a Japanese priest, and recipient of the highest both intellectual and practice education, explains the triple treasure in a very religious, in terms that a very religious Westerner might understand more easily than a Zen student. And it just shows how there's really only one truth. Koban's very pure mind, probably enlightened, has no problem expressing the truth in this way. I'm really amazed at someone with his education has no problem expressing the truth in this way. And thank you for pointing this out. It's very, very good. Well, I'm not seeing any more questions, and I want to inform you that our next series will take a break for the rest of April, and our next series will begin the first Sunday in May. I think it's May 7th, and I want to thank everybody who helps make these talks possible, yourselves. And and the people who listen during the week, and Brian and Sahar and Brendan. I thank you all, and I hope that I'll see you again the first Sunday in May, and have a nice vacation. Bye-bye.